You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump is being condemned by many in Congress after a series of tweets aimed at four Democratic congresswomen. We'll talk about whether or not Trump's rhetoric is anything new when it comes to our discussions of race and politics. First, when it comes to the biggest foreign policy challenges facing the United States, North Korea remains near the top of the list. While President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un recently got together for a historic meeting in the Korean Demilitarized Zone, tensions between the two countries haven't gone away. But to understand how he got there, it can be helpful to look back on why Korea split in the first place. A big part of that, according to our next guest, was due to Syngman Rhee, a political activist who spent a lot of his life in the United States and became South Korea's first president. In a new book, he explains how Rhee's decades-long lobbying campaign for a free Korea unintentionally helped pave the way for the creation of the two countries, North and South Korea, and how he sold Americans on caring about Korea in the first place. David Fields is the associate director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. His new book is called Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
David, for a lot of the American population, there have always been two Koreas, but looking at your book and looking back at the prehistory, pre-division, there was nothing inevitable about that, was there?
No, not at all. In fact, Koreans share about 4,000 years of history on that Korean peninsula as one people. And so even for the Koreans themselves, division is seen as something that's a fairly recent development and something that they hope is not going to last much longer.
And I think you're interested in myth-busting, if we can call it that, for Americans and our understanding of the Koreas. And from our perspective, this is a country that went through this vicious, horrific, destructive war in the 1950s and a not very peaceful peace. Since then, It's easy to imagine that this is a very divided people who have a lot of animosity toward each other. You're saying not necessarily so.
The relationship between North Koreans and South Koreans is very complicated. And they don't primarily view, or actually I should say the South Koreans don't primarily view the North Koreans as the enemy. They really view them as their brothers. I mean, there's many Koreans still to this day, although they're dying out quite rapidly, who have family members on the north side of the line. And so their relationship with North Korea is quite complex, and it leads sometimes for them to, I think, underplay the threat that North Korea actually is to their society.
And on the North Korean side, you've been in North Korea. I know it can be tough to gauge public opinion in a country like North Korea, but do you get a sense of how people there feel about their neighbors to the south?
I think it's actually much more negative, and I think they really view the South as a country that has been manipulated and dominated by the United States for so long that it has lost its essential Koreanness, as the North Koreans understand that to exist. So I would say the Northern Korean opinion of the Southern Korean is much less charitable.
That's North and South Korea. Let's spend some time in the United States now. You write, going back in history, back to the 19th century even, to the extent that Americans, even in foreign policy, thought about Korea, it was an afterthought in many ways.
It was an afterthought, but there was important pockets of grassroots lobbying, of grassroots organizing going on, especially around 1919, 1920, and then during World War II, that was really raising the profile of Korea and of the Japanese colonization of Korea during that time.
And there was a treaty in the late 1800s between the U.S. and Korea, but then you have this Japanese protectorate over Korea, ultimately annexation. That's 1905 to 1910, if I'm remembering my
exactly.
Years right. And this feeling of betrayal from Koreans, including Syngman Rhee, who we're going to bring in just a moment, and from some American supporters of Korea. Can you talk about that pivotal moment in our relationship?
Sure. In 1882, the United States and Korea sign a treaty. And the first article of that treaty says that if any third party deal with either of these two nations, the other will exert their good offices to help mediate the situation. Now, good offices is a technical legal term that referred to mediation. But when that treaty was translated into Korean, there was no equivalent legal term in Korean, and so it was translated as must help. So many Koreans, including Koreans in government, the emperor, Gojong, believed that they had signed an alliance with the United States. So as Japan began the process of annexing Korea in 1905, Gojong dispatched several emissaries to the United States, including Sigmund Rhee, to ask for American assistance under that treaty. And all of those requests were denied because, in fact, it was not an alliance. The United States was not obligated to come to Korea's aid at that time.
Talking to David Fields about his new book, Foreign Friends, Sigmund Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. I will admit I was completely ignorant of Sigmund Rhee and his time in America, but it's this amazing story. He was here lobbying, barnstorming, speaking around the country, trying to hold what he said was Americans to American ideals to come to the aid in one way or another of Korea. Talk about his time in the United States.
He comes to the United States at a very propitious time. He arrives the first time in 1904. In 1907, a massive Christian revival breaks out on the Korean Peninsula called the Great Pyongyang Revival. And because of this revival, Korea becomes the most successful foreign mission field for American missionaries. And now there is all this interest in the rapid growth of Korean Christianity. And so Sigmund Rhee happens to be the right person at the right time who can tour around the United States in places like Winona, Minnesota. I mean, he may have even come to Madison. I've not found a record of that, but he was in Winona, Minnesota, explaining this revival to American Methodists and Presbyterians who were hungry for information about why this was happening and what they could do to further this revival.
And he ended up getting a lot of support from these Christians when it came to his hopes for American foreign policy, in which often thoughts of Korea were crowded out because you had China and Japan and Russia involved, too, for that matter.
Yeah, Sigmund Rhee was very clever at this period of his lobbying, and he understood that Americans didn't really care whether Korea was an independent nation or not, but they did care about the growth of Christianity in Korea. So during this early period of his lobbying, he didn't talk too much about politics. What he said instead was continue to support your missionaries, send more missionaries, send more money to support the growth of Korean Christianity, because he knew the more Christianity continued to grow, the more Americans would be interested. And he also knew that the growth of Christianity in Korea place them on a collision course with the Japanese, and that sooner or later the Japanese would start suppressing Christianity, and he felt that that would be the time to then inject politics into his lobbying.
I'm going to fast forward a little now. I want to take us to 1945. Mm-hmm. Korea has been basically occupied by Japan for 40 years at this point. World War II is over. The Japanese have lost, and the big question mark in Korea was, what are they? Are they independent? Are they a protectorate? What happens there? Can you talk about what was on the table?
Well, Rhee had got tremendously lucky in that he had a great sense of timing. So in the summer of 1941, he writes a book called Japan Inside Out, in which he predicts that there's going to be a conflict between the United States and the Japanese. And this book goes through two printings in the summer of 1941. Well, in December of 1941, when the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, overnight, Rhee turns into a prophet. And he goes touring around the United States saying, see, we Koreans told you so. We told you that if you let the Japanese come onto the Korean Peninsula, if you let them go up into China, sooner or later they were going to attack the United States. And that is, in fact, what happened. And so then his lobbying was, you need to recognize the Korean Provisional Government now during the war to ensure that after the war, Korea will be an independent country that will not be dominated by either of its neighbors, either China, the Soviet Union, or Japan.
We end up with a solution that, as if I'm reading you right, nobody exactly wanted, that we end up with a South Korea and a North Korea, the United States with a military presence in one, the Soviets in the North.
That's exactly right. There was no one advocating the division of Korea, especially not Sigmund Rhee. He was horrified as soon as he learned about this decision. But how this happens is his lobbying is so effective and his grassroots organizations are so effective at putting pressure on American congressmen that they in turn put pressure on the Truman administration. You have to do something for Korea. You have to make sure that Korea emerges from the war as an independent nation. The problem is, at the end of the war, the nearest troops to the Korean Peninsula are over 6 weeks away, and the Soviets are already marching down the peninsula. And so they realize that there's no way that they can get there first. So the only hope is to suggest that there are two occupation zones in the Korean Peninsula. And the idea was never that these zones would become permanent separate countries. The idea was just that if there's an American zone, then the Americans have influence and they can shape the Korean state that's going to emerge from the war, hopefully in a positive way. And that is why they suggest the division. It's important to note, the Soviets did not have to accept it. The Soviets could have continued their march down the Korean Peninsula and said, no, thank you. And there's nothing that the Americans could have done about it. But the Soviets did accept it because the next day they asked for an occupation zone in Japan, hoping that they split Korea with the United States, that the Japanese would then split – or sorry, the Americans would then split Japan with the Soviet Union. We did not do that. And then, of course, the joint occupation of Korea gets off to a very rocky start from day one.
We're talking to David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. His new book is Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. David, let's talk about North Korea today. We were chatting just before the interview, and you pointed out something that I hadn't really thought about. North Korea, we often call it a communist country, not necessarily so anymore.
No, and this is something that I think is so important to understand because communism for Americans provides a false roadmap that we try to follow. We know from the experience of the mid-1990s that communist countries either collapse or they reform along Chinese lines where they have a market economy, but they have an authoritarian political structure. And so I think a lot of people are waiting. When is North Korea going to do one of those things? Is it going to collapse or is it going to reform? Well, in fact, North Korea went through its own transition that was unique in the early 1990s, and they moved from a Stalinist type of communism to something that's very hard to explain. And I think the best way to explain it is North Korea almost operates as a religion, where Kim Jong-un, well, the Kims and now Kim Jong-un, function as the deity of that religion. I spent some time in North Korea in 2010, and I came back and I wrote a piece called True Believers, because I became convinced during that time that North Koreans understand that their lives are difficult. They understand that their lives are not perfect. They no longer believe the propaganda completely. And in fact, the regime no longer even tries to tell them that they live the best lives in the world. But they believe in the beneficence and the benevolence of their leader. And so I talked to North Koreans who couldn't understand necessarily why they weren't allowed to travel abroad, why they didn't get foreign news in North Korea. But ultimately, they told me, well, there must be a reason for it. And we trust our leader. We believe that our leader knows what's best for us. And that is the way this society works. But it's not communism because North Korea no longer even pretends to provide the basic needs of its citizens. It is essentially let all but the people who are essential to the function of the state go, and it doesn't care what happens to them. It focuses all of its resources on the 2 to 3 million people that are essential for the functioning of the state. So North Korea has already gone through this transition where they have abandoned communism, and now it functions on a very, very different basis.
The way you describe it makes me think a different C word here, not communism, but cult.
I think that's a fair way of describing it. The definition of a cult, I think, is that you believe in the beneficence of the leader and you can't leave. I mean, those are the two things that, you know, make up a cult, and that's exactly what North Korea is. You can't leave North Korea. You can sneak out of the country. You can defect, but there's no way that you can voluntarily get out of it. And this is a real problem because when we look at what Kim Jong-un is saying about development, this has got some people very excited and think that North Korea is actually changing. And that could be the case. And I like to be an optimist, and I hope that North Korea is changing for the better. But another way that you can look at some of his reforms is he's actually just making tweaks to make this whole system run better. These markets are not to feed the North Korean people, but these markets are to make sure that the 1 or 2% of North Koreans that are essential to the function of the state, that their lives are a little bit better, and therefore the regime is a little bit more stable.
Talking to David Fields from UW-Madison. His new book is Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. We're talking about the division of Korea and the divisions in Korea past and present. Let's go to a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is kind of just a reflection, which is that I can remember when Bill Clinton was running for president, he said North Korea would never have a nuclear weapon. When George W. Bush was running for president, he reiterated the same thing. Barack Obama did the same thing. When they blew up a nuclear bomb, Susan Rice said, well, it's time to accept North Korea as a nuclear power. I guess I am wondering why the only person who seems to be doing anything constructive is President Trump, and why there is so much resistance to his policies.
Charlie, thanks for the call. What do you make of the dialogue between President Trump and Kim Jong-un?
First, I think we need to understand a little bit about the geography of the Korean Peninsula. So Seoul is within artillery range of the DMZ. So at any time, there are probably tens of thousands of artillery pieces trained on the city of Seoul that could destroy the city of Seoul in moments.
And millions of people.
And this has been the case since the 1950s. So one of the reasons why it was always impossible to deal with North Korean nuclear weapons in the program is even before they had detonated the nuclear device was the North Koreans essentially have the city of Seoul hostage. And they've had it hostage since the 1950s. So any attempt to deal with their weapons program literally put 10 million lives at risk. And I think all American policymakers up to this point have looked at that calculus and have said, we really don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons, but we are not willing to risk 10 million South Korean citizens, the 10 most populous city in the world, for this program. So what do we do instead? We cannot stop them from developing the program, but we can prevent them from ever being legitimately recognized as a nuclear power. So the idea has always been we go at them with our allies. We show a united front to the North Koreans. Maybe we can't stop you from doing this, but we can isolate you from doing this. We can make it hard on your economy for doing this. And hopefully at some point, maybe the North Korean leadership will think about this differently, and maybe they would make a different decision. I honestly don't think that's the case. So I think what we have is stalemate for the foreseeable future, in which no one wants the North Koreans to have nuclear weapons, but there's nothing that we can do to stop that.
Now, how about President Trump's personal diplomacy, trying to build a strange buddy system here where he can talk to Kim Jong-un directly? Could there be benefits from that?
So I am not personally a supporter of the president's strategy. And the reason I'm not is because I think when you have a problem like North Korea where there is no obvious solution, what you do is you make sure that you're united with your allies, that you show a unified front towards this problem. What the president has done instead is he has gone alone. And he has allowed the North Koreans to define this as an issue between North Korea and the United States, not an issue between North Korea and the world. And so if his efforts break down, the blame for this is going to fall on the United States in the way it has not before. We have always dealt with North Korea as a part of the six-party talks or as a part of coalition of nations going to North Korea. Now, having said that, I think that the president's chances of a breakthrough on North Korea are very, very slim. If by some miracle he can pull it off, he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, and I will sit in the front row if invited and clap for him because it will be a remarkable coup. I don't think that this will happen. I think that the North Koreans are only involved in these talks because they sense an opportunity here to perhaps drive a wedge between the United States and our allies.
For years, Kim, I think a couple different Kims now, have wanted one-on-one talks with the leader of the United States. President Trump has suggested that President Obama had wanted that and the North Koreans had rejected it. Some people have been saying, hold on, this is what North Korea's wanted all along. Why? Is this a propaganda win with his own people to have him standing there as an equal with the president of the United States?
Sure, it's a propaganda win, but it's also a way of splitting up a coalition, right? It's easier to deal with the United States alone. And it also, in a certain way, it delegitimizes South Korea, right? The South Koreans bear the brunt of the North Korean threat. It's their peninsula that's divided. And the northern regime does not believe in the legitimacy of the South Korean government. And so by going over them and dealing directly with the United States, in a way, it confirms the regime's propaganda that South Korea is just a puppet state of the United States. Also, I think one of the long-term objectives of North Korea is to get the United States off of the Korean Peninsula.
Like militarily?
Militarily. So they would like nothing better than a formal declaration of an end to the Korean War, and that would be the first step towards chipping away at the forces that have kept the United States in the Korean Peninsula since 1950.
Why do they want the U.S. military out of South Korea? I mean, worst case, is would that be a opening to invade South Korea again 60 years later?
Exactly.
70?
I mean, the long-term goal of the North Korean regime has always been the reunification of the Korean Peninsula. Now, I think they understand that that is not viable in the near future. It's not viable as long as the United States is on the Korean Peninsula. But I think that they're playing a very long game here. As I said, the Korean Peninsula has 4,000 years of history, and they're thinking decades, if not centuries, into the future. And the surest way to reunite the Korean Peninsula, if that's ever going to happen, is going to be to get the Americans off the peninsula first.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Fields is the Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. His new book is called Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. We've been talking about American foreign policy in North and South Korea and U.S. involvement in the original division of the countries in the first place. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump is being criticized after a series of racist tweets aimed at progressive first-term congresswomen believed to be Representatives Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ilhan Omar. Trump tweeted that the group came from other countries and should, quote, go back and help the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, end quote. All four representatives are U.S. citizens. Three were born in the country. The congresswoman responded at a press conference yesterday. Here's a listen to Representative Omar talking about Trump's rhetoric.
He's launching a blatantly racist attack on four duly elected members of the United States of House of Representatives, all of whom are women of color. This is the agenda of white nationalists, whether it is happening in chat rooms or it's happening on national TV, and now it's reached the White House garden.
Here's President Trump talking to reporters on the White House lawn earlier today.
And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave. They can leave, and you know what? I'm sure that there'll be many people that won't miss them. But they have to love our country, their congresspeople. And I never used any names, but these are people, quiet.
Jennifer Murcia is an associate professor at Texas A&M University. She's an expert in the history of American political discourse and author of the book Founding Fictions. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
That's my pleasure.
You've been following President Trump and his language since the campaign. What do you make of some of the latest developments and what we've seen from these tweets and now this back and forth response?
Yeah, it's very consistent with what we saw during the 2016 election and the 2018 election. Trump is very comfortable pushing those racial buttons. He knows what riles up his base. He knows what will antagonize his opposition. And he's very comfortable in pushing those buttons, and he does it routinely.
And let's talk about the go back to your country as a part of American history. This isn't the first time this has been directed at people of immigrant background in their generation or in the generation or two before they came.
Oh, absolutely. There's a long history in our nation of not accepting new immigrants. Every time there's a new wave of immigrant migration, you know, there's always backlash. And so there's just a long history in this country of not living up to the ideals that we promise, right, in the Declaration of Independence.
You've written in the past about how the president's language is received, not in the mainstream or from his opponents, but from white nationalist organizations and people on white nationalist websites. What do you see there?
Yeah, this is what I found really fascinating about what happened sort of below the surface during the 2016 election. Almost immediately when Trump announced his campaign, white nationalists took an interest in him. They took an interest in the things that he was saying about immigration in particular. And they decided pretty quickly, at least some of them did, that they were going to support his campaign. Other white nationalist groups were debating whether or not Trump was truly one of them. And eventually they decided that because of two things that Trump had said in the past and that he was saying still during the campaign, that he was one of them. One is his racehorse theory of genetics. He is on record. You can Google this. I'm sure you don't have it ready to go for your listeners right now, but they can Google him and his racehorse theory, and they'll find lots of evidence of him saying that he comes from superior genes and that he believes that he has passed those superior genes on to his children and that he's a part of a superior race. So white nationalists like that. And then the other thing that they really liked about Trump in 2016 was that they thought that he was on the right side of what they called the nationalism question, which is that they heard Trump saying that white people deserve their own nation and that he was going to purify the nation for them, right? So these are people who hear the word diversity and they call that white genocide. They think that that's polluting or destroying the white race. They believe themselves to be in a race war already, and they saw Trump as someone who was either already on their side or someone who they could use sort of as a stooge in some ways to get their message out.
Talking to Jennifer Mercia, associate professor at Texas A&M University, about President Trump's Twitter and then out loud comments about members of Congress, women of color. And Jennifer, the argument from the president and some in the White House, including Kellyanne Conway and the president's supporters, is that this wasn't about race. This was about the patriotism and love of country that he says should be exhibited by members of Congress. Is that a fair defense?
Well, so it's an interesting thing. America is an idea, and there isn't one person who gets to define what America means or who is American. So certainly not just the president. That's a conversation that we all have together. And Donald Trump was someone who was very critical of the government when he was not in charge of it. Right. But it is true that to be a patriot in this country, we often think of that as uncritical nationalism, right? As just sort of agreeing with anything that the country does or the president might say. But the actual history of patriotism dating, to the Revolutionary War meant that you were critical of the government, that you were someone who defended the ideals of the Constitution and eventually of the Declaration of Independence. So it meant that you defended the community against the government.
Is there something different in the age of social media and politics that make it more effective to have messages like those of the president? Do they travel better in the online world than they might have, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. That's such a great question. Right. So all social media algorithms are designed to promote outrage, right? So the more outrageous thing that you say or the president says or that I say, the more people will actually see that tweet. And of course, that will cause more outrage, which will cause more engagement. It's all designed to keep us attending to that network or that platform, so that we can be engaged. And the way they do that is obviously through emotion. So Trump is a master at playing this game. He is great at attracting attention. So what he did on Sunday with these tweets, I think that was no accident. Like I said before, I think he's very comfortable towing that sort of racism line. And he's certainly not afraid of it. And I think that he knew that he would get a lot of attention for it. And if you think about what we're not paying attention to over the last 3 days while we're, wondering whether or not Trump is a racist, there are a lot of other really important stories that make Trump look not so good. Roger Stone was in court today. Jeffrey Epstein was in court yesterday. We heard that WikiLeaks, Julian Assange was visited specifically in the Ecuadorian embassy, and so there's all kinds of stories that are unfolding that we're maybe not paying enough attention to right now.
Talking to Jennifer Mercia, historian of American political discourse, about rhetoric on race and politics we're seeing after President Trump's recent tweets and comments aimed at Democratic congresswomen. Jennifer, there are concerns about declines in civility in American political life. We've had some rocky moments in the past, too. What do you see as the trends when it comes to whether we're able to have civil conversations even at the highest levels?
Yeah, that's a really interesting problem that we're having right now. I think that part of the outrage and attention economy makes it more difficult for us to have productive conversations. And I would use the word productive as opposed to civil, because what I think we're trying to do is to figure out ways to solve problems. Sometimes we might need to be uncivil in order to solve problems, right? Sometimes issues need to be raised, and they need to be raised in a way that, you know, isn't polite, because sometimes people are excluded from those conversations. But that can still be productive. But the way that the attention economy works and the outrage industry, the fact that we have less face-to-face communication than we used to, that we have failed to join political organizations that help to teach us democratic deliberation and skills related to having productive conversations. Those are all bad, bad for productive conversations that we could be having and should be having. So yeah, I'm actually very concerned about that.
Whose job is it to fix that?
Well, you know, I'm in a communication department, and there are communication departments at universities and community colleges around the country that teach citizenship skills through communication. We teach democratic deliberation, and it's a popular major. So we have a lot of students who are interested in these things. But yeah, I mean, in terms of how it works in the public sphere, you know, not all media is NPR, unfortunately. And, you know, cable news, it functions the same way the rest of the outrage and attention economy does. You know, it's all about putting emotive content and partisanship and polarization front and center, and it's not so interested in problem solving.
What could be done? Let's look at social media in particular. There are a lot of conversations going on about this in European governments, to some extent in the United States. Do there need to be regulations, or would you like to see the Twitters and YouTubes and whatnot to police themselves, regulate themselves better to not steer people to the outrage?
Well, so it's hard to know exactly what's going to solve the problem. We know that some of the problem exists because of the way that the algorithms are constructed, right? And so somebody like Tristan Harris will tell you that there are 1,000 engineers who spend all day, every day, trying to figure out more ways to get you addicted to your social media platforms, right? And that they're very good at it, right? They trigger the dopamine receptors in your brain, and they really addict you to the feedback that you get from posting outrageous content. But then, you know, on the other side of the coin, there are organizations like the Kettering Foundation that teaches people how to organize really productive civic dialogues in their communities. And anyone can learn to organize those kinds of conversations, and they can be used to solve problems. Part of the problem that we have right now is that we don't trust anyone to be a sort of neutral arbiter, either of truth or of our conversation, right? We don't trust the platforms. We don't trust news organizations, particularly if we think they're slanted from the other perspective. We don't trust political parties. We don't trust the opposition party. We don't trust the government. And so part of the breakdown in society right now is that we have this fundamental lack of trust. And so part of that is that we don't know who to trust to help us to organize our conversations to be more productive.
Let's bring on a caller now. Teresa is with us in Menominee Falls. Teresa, hi.
Yes, hi. My comment is I'm less concerned about the personal tweets that Trump gives to the congresswomen and other people in politics and the world. I'm more concerned about the exponential effect that it has on the United States and our citizens. So when somebody goes to Burger King and they're sitting there and hear somebody speaking Spanish, they consider it their right and okay and wonderful to torment, bully, and intimidate people who never asked for it, have no deserving of it. And so the congresswomen and the women of the legislative and political, they can roll with it. It's the common citizens that are traumatized.
Teresa, thanks. Don't have too much time left. Going to jump in. Jen, a trickle-down effect, she's saying, in effect, from the president's language.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a poll done by Pew this year where people said that since Trump was elected, 65% believe that it is more common for people to express racist or racially insensitive views. So I think that there is a great majority of people in this country that really believe that Trump has said these kinds of things in public. And so now it's okay that we all do that. You know, it's okay to be racist now.
Teresa,
it's a problem.
Thanks for your call. And just our last minute, Jen, what are you watching for now as we kick off this new presidential campaign?
I'm looking for someone to be able to hold Trump accountable, right? So part of the problem in 2016 was that Trump was an unaccountable leader. He was never held to account for any of the things that he said or did, not by his party. The media had a hard time. Trump was able to play sort of journalistic norms against them. And he was so good for ratings that it was hard for them to combat, you know, what he was doing. And so I'm really interested to see in 2020 if there's any institution or organization that is able to sort of match Trump's power. He's a powerful rhetorician.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer Mercia, historian of American political discourse at Texas A&M University. She was with us to talk about President Trump's rhetoric in the wake of recent tweets targeting four Democratic congresswomen. Demand for hazelnuts is increasing across the globe, due in part to brands like Nutella and its sweet chocolate spread. Production's on the rise in the U.S., but it pales next to Turkey, which grows around 70% of the world's supply. As Danielle Kading reports, researchers in the upper Midwest say hazelnuts have the potential to become a new crop for farmers in the region.
This is the sound of a machine used to process hazelnuts that Ariadna Chediak calls the cracker.
And when I turn the drill, the nut is cracked in here.
Chediak is an agricultural research assistant with the University of Wisconsin Extension. Those cracked hazelnuts fall onto a vibrating metal tray. From there, the kernels drop into a large container while pieces of the shell are sucked away. The nuts are being processed at the Northland College Food Center in Ashland for the American Hazelnut Company in southern Wisconsin. Chediak says the work is part of a larger effort to create a sustainable hazelnut industry from the American hazelnut, which grows wild in northern Wisconsin.
Well, this is a good area because there are native ones in here, and people used to harvest and collect. And
Todd Rothy, who manages the Northland College Food Center, says hazelnuts are just one crop that could be grown locally to benefit the region.
If we can identify at least one hazelnut product that could be processed, packaged, and distributed from our area, that's going to create jobs, keep dollars circulating locally, help build, you know, our local economy here.
The Universities of Wisconsin and Minnesota formed the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative more than a decade ago to identify the best hazelnut seedlings for commercial production. They're now cloning those seedlings, which will start going out to growers next spring. UW Extension Agriculture Agent Jason Fishbach co-leads the initiative. He says hazelnuts could be a way to tap into the $34 billion global nut market.
And Wisconsin doesn't participate in that at all.
He says the American hazelnut could follow in the footsteps of another Wisconsin native, cranberries. The state grows more than 60% of the nation's cranberry supply. But he says hazelnuts take time to grow, with no harvest expected until 4 years after planting. Fishbach says the upfront costs are similar to fruit crops like apples and blueberries.
But then, once it's established and growing, you've got a low input. Basically, just do some weed control and harvesting, and you've got big income for years and years and years.
Agronomy professor Don Wise with the University of Minnesota says farmers can still earn money off the land while hazelnut trees mature.
They can be grown in an alley cropping system where you can farm between the rows.
He says hazelnuts have potential to become a major oil and protein crop for the upper Midwest, and the mature trees also offer environmental benefits.
And gives complete soil cover, excellent nutrient management, no erosion.
Other researchers, like horticulture professor Jed Cahoon with UW-Madison, says they're exploring a variety of native plants, fruits, and crops grown in other parts of the world that could hold potential for Wisconsin farmers.
Unfortunately, we find ourselves not only in the corn, soy, dairy world, but even in the specialty fruit and vegetable crops in an oversupply situation in many cases. So what we're really trying to do is figure out what our climate, soils, and unique production characteristics can do to give us a niche in agriculture that can't be replicated as easily elsewhere.
Fishbach thinks hazelnuts will be part of the mix. He says production costs in Wisconsin are lower than Oregon, which produces the vast majority of hazelnuts in the U.S. Plus, he thinks the flavor of native hazelnuts may favor the region.
So when people eat a fresh harvested, fresh roasted hazelnut, their eyes just explode. They're so excited. They just taste amazing.
If people follow their taste buds, Fishbach is confident the market will follow too. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.